From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Should 18-year-old girls register for the draft just like their male counterparts?
We're being fed a bill of goods that this is about equal rights, and if women have equal rights, then they should be drafted too. All of this is garbage, okay? Equal rights do not mean that we must do the same things.
We'll talk about that and a lot more in the break room. First, though, we talked yesterday about the legacy of the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, and we asked for your memories. So here are your first thoughts. This is Ted Hall of Atlanta.
I had the privilege of attending the American track and field trials, the first event actually to be held in what is now Turner Field, and before it was even used for the Olympics. And it was the first and only time I ever got a sense of the physical majesty of the hammer throw. When I watched that ball on a cable launch from that athlete's hand and just soar up and up and up like it was going to escape the atmosphere, I've never been more amazed at any sporting event in my life.
We always love to get your stories. You can call and leave a message like Ted did at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the show. Songwriter Andra Day started out singing other people's hits. Her covers received millions of YouTube views, but she found commercial success when she established a musical voice of her own. Her voice has been featured in ads for Beats by Dre and Apple TV, and she's also performed at the White House. Andra Day will perform at the Tabernacle in Atlanta this weekend, and she joins me now to talk about her music and career. Hi, Andra. The first reason a lot of people viewed your covers even before they knew your voice was that you chose really interesting songs to cover. Things that people would not expect. So let's hear one of those. This is your acoustic version of Lose Yourself by Eminem.
Snap back to reality, the ghost gravity, the ghost gravity choke. He's so mad, but he won't give up that easy. No, he won't have it. He knows his whole back to these ropes. It don't matter, he's dope, he knows that, but he's broke. He's so sad that he knows when he goes back to this mobile home. That's when it's back to the lab again. Yo, this whole rhapsody, better go capture this moment. You better lose yourself.
So when somebody linked that to me, I have to be frank with you. I was like, this is going to be terrible, because
if you
describe someone singing to a rap song, yeah, it'd be like, oh, my God. And I'm glad I listened to it, because obviously it's great. But how do you make that work? How did you go about trying to find a melody and a way of singing that would make it not sound silly when compared to the rap original?
So, I think with covers, it's, kind of doing justice to the original artist, because it's their vision originally, but also putting your own spin on it, like you have to kind of mold it into yourself. You have to make it work with you. And to be honest, especially with, I actually love singing and doing covers of hip hop songs, because I'm a big fan of hip hop. I love doing songs that men sang originally and or rapped and flipping them. But, I will say that it's my background in jazz that allows me to do that pretty easily. So it wasn't like I had to really, really sit down and figure out, oh, no, what am I going to do? I come from a background in jazz, so it's almost similar to scatting, right? You're just sort of on the fly improvising the notes and what it is that you want to sing. And so that background kind of makes being able to sort of rap sing a little bit easier, because each word that you sort of spit, is almost like a note, in itself. And so I liken it to scatting when I'm doing that.
So you not only have a background in jazz, but if your official biography is correct, mm-hmm, you very first started singing in the church. Is that right?
Yeah. Pretty much like everyone else.
Yeah. So I wonder what effect you think that has. Does that affect your, I guess, development as a musician when you begin in the church?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you're sort of surrounded by musicians. And I think also for me, singing in church sort of at a younger age, even though I like lost it when I was like 21, that was crazy. but at a younger age in church too, it's kind of, you're singing for a purpose, you're aware that it's while you're up there singing, it's about the audience and not just you. It's about their experience.
So it's funny that you say that, because actually your biggest hit, Rise Up, kind of reminds me almost of a gospel song.
Yeah, yeah.
It's clear you were singing it for another purpose.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? Honestly, that's one of the things. The development hasn't just been musical. For me as a person, it's been emotional, it's been spiritual, it's been mental. And so I'm at a place now where I realize I don't want to just create music to just be. You know, I want it to do something. I want it to serve a purpose. I want it to impact people. And I want people who hear it to realize that the things that they create and the things that they do can impact people as well. So all of the music, every song starts with praying. I always pray before I do every song, album, whatever I'm working on. And with that song in particular, I just wanted to, I was sort of like, what would I want to hear right now? You know, I've told the story of my life and the experiences, but what would just be like a nudge, you know, that would just help me stand to my feet, weather this storm?
My guest is singer-songwriter Andra Day, and she will be at the Tabernacle in Atlanta tomorrow. So the other thing that is interesting about your jazz background is that, you know, your style is very sort of modernized, retro. I mean, you could totally see Billie Holiday wearing what you wear, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, she's like pretty much the reason I do the music I do.
So I wonder, how does the style intersect with the art? Would you be Andra Day the same if you didn't have that style? Would Lady Gaga be the same if she were not stylistically Lady Gaga? Where does that intersection come?
I think it's all. I mean, you know, they all still would have talent. They would all, you know, but I think when it comes to art talent, it's not just talent, but it's a vision as well, too. And for me, I think, you know, with the visual, it's all a part of the art. It's all, I think the aesthetic is important. I think, you know, the music is important. It's all a package. Like if your desire is to really create a great, unique experience for your audience, then the visuals matter. You know, I think all of that, it matters to me. And clearly, you know, when I think of an artist like Lady Gaga, who was an artist all around, it matters to her. And so, I mean, but I think that's what made, you know, Freddie Mercury amazing. That's what made Queen amazing. You know, that's all of these artists, Prince, Michael Jackson, like their aesthetic was also a part of their art. And so to me, I think the two are linked. They go hand in hand. Even if your aesthetic is simple, you know, and there's nothing, you know, if that's what you want to portray to people in the visual, then that's your art, you know. And so for me, I think, quote unquote, Andra Day, I hate to talk about myself in third person, but it is. It's the aesthetic, it's the music, it's the message, it's, you know, the lyrics, the whole experience, or how you interact with me when I'm performing or I'm engaging with you. All of that matters, you know.
So let's hear, I want to take a listen to a mashup that you did of two songs I would never have thought. I mean, that's one of the things that is great about you as an artist, is how surprising you are. But where you blended Amy Winehouse and Lauryn Hill's big hit, Doo-Wop.
He can only hold her for so long. The lights are on, but no one's home. She's so vacant, her soul is taken. He thinks, where's she running from?
What occurred to me when I was listening to that is that I can't imagine a non-musician knowing how to do that. And there are so many pop stars that don't actually read music or study music.
Right.
So what do you think that adds? The study of music itself, does that change you as an artist?
Oh, my goodness. For me, and again, like it's not like I'm not this amazing sight reader or I'm not. But I did train. I did jazz vocal performance. We did classical music. An opera for a brief stint as well. And honestly, I always tell people that musical education opens up an entire well of musical wisdom, like for you to be able to pull from. Because for me, that's why jazz singers grabbed my attention. You know, not because their voices were more amazing than like a Whitney or a, you know, a Celine Dion or Patti or, you know, but it's their note choice and their phrasing. You know, it's like that's why, you know, Miles Davis was who he was because of his phrasing, you know. And so for me, jazz was like, oh my goodness, I can take a straight pop song and completely choose different notes. I can do everything in minor, you know, and I can choose to sing it that way and make it sound so different and make it sound interesting. And we actually did a cover of Lionel Richie's Hello, and that song I love so much because it lends itself to be sort of major, brighter, or minor, darker, you know. And so we went darker with it, and it just, that's what I love about jazz. It's the note choice, it's the phrasing, it makes everything you do sound infinitely more interesting, in my opinion.
I mean, this has been a kind of an explosive growth in your career, it seems to me. I mean, I'm sure for you, having spent all those years before people knew your name, it doesn't seem like it was all that fast.
No, it was not. Everybody's like, oh my God, girl, you showed up overnight. And I'm like, yeah, 15 years ago. Yeah, it popped up like a jack in the box. It only took 15 years to wind me up. But, you know, I heard somebody say that a long time ago. They were like, you know, it takes the build up, like the bottom of the iceberg, you know, it takes forever to build up, to grow. Because I realize, though, when I look back on that now, because you're not just building musically, you know, you're not just building your visuals, you're building who you are as a human being, as a person. And, you know, you have to be able to sustain that, you know, so it has to be genuine, it has to be real. And so all of that, there's a lot of just, you know, growth that happens during that time. But then they did say when it happens, it seems like it's so quick, you know. So
it finally starts. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, now it's just crazy because it's hard for me to accept the fact that the album itself only came out like a year and a half ago. It feels like it's been years, and I'll talk about experiences and I'm like, oh yeah, that was like 3 years ago, right? They're like, no, Andra, the album came out August 2015. So but it's been amazing and I'm grateful for it. I'm definitely not sleeping as much as I should be, but you know, it's my dream and bigger than what I actually kind of imagined it would be, especially on the first album.
And I wonder how you feel that has prepared you all those years before you hit. Mm-hmm. And I say that in reference to there are a certain percentage of artists that are kind of plucked out of childhood and their stars are sort of created.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder how different the experience is when you have all those years already of experience of trying as a musician before the stardom hits.
Yeah, honestly, I love it. And, you know, obviously we have amazing musicians who came out of childhood. We have Stevie, we have Michael, you know, and so on and so forth. And so, but honestly, for me, I look back, you know, now because I'm 31, right? So all of this started in with the covers and all of this 2012. So I was late 20s, now early 30s. And I actually, when I was young, it was like, oh, it'll happen at 18, it'll happen at 21. But now I'm so grateful for the age I am now and it happening, because I know who I am completely. And I think for me, that's so integral to what it is that I do. And the success of this project is that I, you know, I'm collaborative, or if I hear a great idea, I'm excited about it. But who I am is who I am. And I'm not going to compromise that, because, again, I have to, you know, sustain it. And so I don't think I would have been prepared for that when I was like 21 or when I was like 18 years old.
Singer-songwriter Andra Day will perform at the Tabernacle in Atlanta tomorrow night at 8. Her debut album, Cheers to the Fall, was released just last year.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, the Break Room Gang joins me to talk about Donald Trump's tweets and fake news. But first, we'll take a stunt driving course right here in Atlanta. This is On Second Thought. And I rise up, I like the waves, I rise up, in spite of the ache, I rise up. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Georgia's $2 billion film industry has put Atlanta on the map as Hollywood of the South, or some call it Yollywood. There's a growing demand for actors, producers, grips, technicians, stuntmen, and women. This year, a veteran stunt driver opened a school for aspiring stunt drivers in Georgia. And GPB's Taylor Gant and Sean Powers visited the school for a crash course in stunt driving.
Hi, I'm Taylor Gant.
And I'm Sean Powers.
And a few weeks ago, we were in Dawsonville, Georgia, about an hour and a half north of Atlanta.
We met this guy named Robert Dillman, who puts us in a bit of a predicament.
So what you guys are going to do is you're going to stand back to back, feet together, arms down at your side.
Robert Dillman is one of the instructors at Bobby Orr Motorsports.
He's teaching us a lesson in stunt driving, and we're helping out as the props.
Bobby's going to come in fairly high speed. He He's going to do a precision drift around you. He's going to start a little wider, closely cut into your feet. By the end of this, he's going to be so close that when he stops, you guys can both sit on the car.
And this is 100% success rate. No one's been delimbed yet.
Absolutely.
All right, let's do this thing then.
Okay, if we don't make it through this, I want my family to know I love them so much.
So, to set the scene, Sean and I are standing back-to-back in the middle of a stunt-driving obstacle course while a car does donuts a few inches away from our toes.
And the man behind the wheel?
My name is Bobby Orr. I own Bobby Orr Motorsports. We're up here at AMP, Georgia, looking to teach all we can.
Bobby Orr is a veteran stuntman and the lead instructor of this stunt-driving school. He started out on the West Coast, but this year opened a program in Georgia in response to the state's booming film industry.
Bottom line is, you know, there's a lot of business here in Georgia right now, a lot of new people and all that, and some of them haven't had the chance to go to a school and get training and all that. So we offer that training, and we're probably the hardest school out there, but at the same time, we turn out some good product, some good drivers and all.
Orr has trained a number of high-profile Hollywood talents over the years, and he has performed stunts himself. His credits include Being John Malkovich, The Dukes of Hazzard, and Seabiscuit. But he especially remembers his time with one A-list actor from the hit movie Gone in 60 Seconds about a group that plans a car heist.
Thanks for doing this. Keep it real. Think slow. We should get through it just fine.
Nicolas Cage came out to the school. Worked with me the day, and I was really surprised because he came out there and initially, to be honest, I thought it was going to be a prima donna kind of a thing because they had a couple of motorhomes for him and all that. That man came there to work. I mean, he got there, he asked who was going to be teaching him. It was me. We got in the car. We were in that car until it was time for lunch. And then ate lunch real quick. We got back in that car. He busted his rear end. Hats off to him.
Stars like Nicolas Cage have been a familiar sight here in Georgia. Jennifer Brett covers the film industry in the state. She says studios can't pass up on the financial incentives.
Filming in Georgia it just makes dollars and cents for Hollywood. They can get a tremendous tax benefit. And as the industry has come here, the infrastructure has sort of blossomed all around it.
Stunt drivers are one of the groups benefiting from the increased number of film and television productions in Georgia. Atlanta native Max Calder decided to pursue his career behind the wheel in his home state instead of going west.
When I started, the tax incentives just passed here back in 2008, I think they passed. So met some people and they said a lot of work's starting to come here, so you should stick around, train, get to know people, and get like a foot in the industry here, because it's hard to break in L.A. It takes about, rule of thumb, 5 years minimum to break in, but got lucky and came here at the right time.
And Calder's decision to stay in Georgia has paid off so far. He's worked on big-budget projects like The Walking Dead series, Marvel's Ant-Man, and Furious 7.
And speaking of a payoff, let's return to our personal stunt driving lesson with Bobby Orr and see if we kept all our toes.
We're good, man. We're all good.
Oh my God. That was amazing. Thank you. Now, has that ever not worked out?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
Thankfully, stunt car driver Bobby Orr's years of experience paid off, and our feet remain unharmed. Orr hopes his students will produce similar results on movie sets across Georgia.
I'm Taylor Gant.
And I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
It has been yet another long week, aren't they all? Like every Friday, we have gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Stop singing!
G.I. Jane Christ, why don't they just get it over with? Call her Joan of Arc.
When I first heard that he was tweeting about something that was on this broadcast, again, factually incorrect tweets last night, I kept thinking, doesn't he have, like, a briefing book on ISIS to be reading?
I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next.
Joining us in the break room this week, Falguni Sheth, welcome, a professor of philosophy at Emory's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies, a rookie.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
And also with us, three old hats, Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University. Robbie Medwed is an Atlanta-based LGBT activist and conservative radio talk show host. Greg Williams back as well. The show's called Greg's List. Welcome, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
No, good morning.
Sorry about calling you guys old hats.
That's fine. It's mostly Greg.
All right. Well, our first topic is something you cannot escape, even if you want to, and that is Donald Trump's tweets.
So President-elect Donald Trump has not let up on his Twitter habit, apparently, and one of his latest tweets is calling for people who burn the American flag to be punished with a year in jail or losing their citizenship.
That's the voice of Whoopi Goldberg on The View. Leading up to the election, Donald Trump's campaign advisors pried Twitter away from him for a short period of time. But now that he's won, he's back sometimes late at night. The most questionable tweet came when he said millions of people voted illegally, and that is why he lost the popular vote. So, look, here's the question. Do we think that after he's inaugurated, Donald Trump will continue to tweet at a time when he's speaking for the United States?
Not at all.
You think he'll stop tweeting?
No. I think he's going to keep on going being Trump. Trump will be Trump. He won't change at all.
Yeah, I got to jump in. I fully agree. I don't think he's going to change in the slightest. We keep saying after he wins the primary, he'll change. After he wins the general, he'll change. He hasn't changed. He's not going to change. Trump's going to be Trump.
But his advisors were successful at prying it away
from
him.
For about a day.
No, but he craves the attention.
Yeah,
I mean, the guy can stop it. He can control himself.
It's hard to tell. I mean, the fact is he's making a few kind of statesman-like moves. Not on Twitter, mind you, but, you know, he's kind of looking at certain kinds of selections that are more reasonable. So, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me that he probably will keep tweeting, but I suspect that he's going to get a lot more advising and he might actually listen just because he's a little overwhelmed by just... you know, how much power he has, even for Don, even for the Donald.
I hope so.
Yeah. The president certainly, you know, obviously they have the, you know, the podium at all times. And if you look at what Trump defenders will say, they'll say, oh, look, he tweeted something out and completely changed the conversation. And I think that's a little intellectually dishonest, because if we're changing the conversation, but it's something very bad. In fact, the thing that irked me lately was, you know, the burning the American flag.
Yeah.
And how many people jumped to his defense for it. And I'm thinking, if we're going to celebrate the First Amendment and true limited government, we have to support flag burners, as appalling as that practice is, in my opinion. We have to make sure we're intellectually consistent as well.
I mean, I think that's right, but he's also not an intellectually consistent conservative, right?
Oh, well, I mean I've always called him an undocumented Republican. So,
indeed. Okay. Well, let's move on and stay with politics, though. Since we're speaking of Donald Trump, former Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin recently... stop laughing. I haven't even said it. Recently compared our current mayor, Kasim Reed, to Trump. In a blog post, Franklin said Reed uses bullying tactics, has a thin skin, and attacks those who disagree with him. We all remember the summer when Reed fired Miguel Southwell and then general manager of Atlanta Hartsfield Jackson Airport. The two had apparent disagreements, and here's what Reed had to say.
The fact of the matter is this. Miguel Southwell is fortunate that I don't destroy his career.
Reed went on to say Southwell was taking the issue too personally. And Reed, look, we all know, speaking of Twitter, Kasim Reed can tweet.
See, I actually don't know that he can tweet because he blocked me.
He blocked you.
He blocked me. Wow. And I actually don't dislike him, but I there was a time he...
What did you do to deserve the blocking?
So a few years ago...
asked him a question.
One of his cars parked illegally on a curb and got a ticket from Park Atlanta, which I think was fantastic. And I retweeted a picture of it thinking that, you know, everyone in town gets hit by Park Atlanta, including the mayor. He did not like that. He blocked me. And that's been it.
Yeah. And you didn't follow him under a new name?
I did not. I don't have that kind of time.
Yeah, how naive of
you. It's like a badge of honor.
But you have enough time to tweet a picture.
Friends that will post the their Twitter response. It's a badge of honor for them to say, hey, the mayor has blocked me as well. So.
Well, I don't have that badge. I am not blocked. Anybody else think
day
that
ain't over
is
yet,
a...
Celeste.
Yeah, you did compare. You just played him. Yeah.
Well, this conversation might do it. But, yeah. Okay, so do we think Shirley Franklin is being fair here? But
absolutely. I mean, Kasim Reed has never come across as humble, and so I mean,
being not humble is not the same as being a bully.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Shirley apparently wants to get her name.
I was
back
trying to
in
say
the
polite way.
So.
Well, I mean, the thing is, she could be right, and it could still just be a kind of personal reference, right?
Oh, kind of
taking the context that everybody hate, you know, all the liberals hate Trump, and so why not just kind of use that to make an additional point and kind of, you know, twist the knife a little bit.
And it's easy for these second thoughts, if you will, to get their name in the paper. Mary Margaret Oliver did her annual gun curbing your Second Amendment right bill to get her name out in the paper. So I see a lot of that going on.
Let's not forget the mayoral campaign has just started, and people are looking to get back in the paper. But I will agree that Kasim Reed is really, really thin-skinned. I don't know if he's a bully, but he's definitely thin-skinned.
All right. So let's talk about something else, and it's something we have actually talked about quite a bit on The Break Room, and that is fake news.
You have to be careful, though. You really do. Before you share a story that you see online, make sure it's from a trustworthy source, like me. You need to know that... You can trust me. I have never told a lie in my entire 36 years of life.
Okay. Ellen DeGeneres there. Facebook, after a lot of criticism, is trying to get ahead of fake news. The social networking site initially said they were not responsible for spreading fake news. Now they're trying to regulate some information. Mm-hmm. So my question is, look, I think we can all sort of agree that fake news is a problem. But how do you avoid it? Mm-hmm. How do you personally, what's your best advice for making sure your news is real?
We've talked about this before, me and you, even when we had breakfast. And the danger that we have is, you know, this idea that we could all of a sudden start to license or register journalists. And I see a call for that. And that's really where we need to make sure we avoid going down the path of censorship and people that are promulgating fake news. And you have to distinguish, what is fake news? Is it an onion satire? Should things be registered as, this is always satire. I've now come to, when I post a joke or something, I'm like, this might be fake news, just because I don't want you to post it ad hoc and think it's real. So that's the danger I see, is everybody just haphazardly reposting things, and then there's a national call to register journalists.
But there's also a kind of lack of skepticism, I think, right? I mean, if you're actually falling for this stuff, a lot of this is also speaking to some of your deep-seated biases, which is the point of these fake news stories, is to literally go gotcha to folks who think that such kind of extreme things are possible.
Absolutely.
Although we now have evidence that many of those fake news stories were actually planted by people who were hoping to influence the election.
Yeah,
which is
by playing into people's biases, right?
And that makes it be a danger to our democracy?
I would say my first tactic when I think about it is really, I look who's posting
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
And see the other kind of things that they posted. And the second thing I'll do is see if any other outlet actually has it.
Mm-hmm. And probably also need to stop looking to Facebook for our news sources, right? I mean, it's kind of like a shortcut.
There are far too many people who have no problem sharing something with a headline that's misspelled.
Yeah.
You know, that's really my first giveaway. If the headline's misspelled, if the website's misspelled, you know, there aren't two I's in Disney when they're giving a giveaway. That's got to be your first clue.
That's the double D Disney. It's a little different.
If you can't spell all the words right, something's got to be wrong.
Hector, you're not weighing in here. How do you avoid fake news?
I just think you guys are way above the head of a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people are not that computer literate. So you have to give practical advice. I mean, you have to avoid clickbait, things like that. I mean, most of the people are not going to be figuring out what Twitter is saying, or, you know, people are just browsing the web for news, and they're not that careful. They're not that computer literate. They're not that media literate. So it's a matter of practical advice.
I mean, it might be something like that, but I'm also thinking about, like, you know, my fifth grade grammar school teacher kind of doing a whole thing on critical media, right? This was like a long time ago. I won't tell you how old I am. I know I look pretty good for my age, but
she does.
Right? Where, you know, she basically kind of took us through a whole bunch of things like headlines. Look at the headlines. What do they say? Right. Look at the story. How, you know, so the New York Daily News, because I grew up outside of New York City, right? New York Daily News, New York Post. What are they posting? What's in the article itself? Now, part of this, I mean, Hector might be right that, you know, people are just not that computer savvy. And we've made this move from hard copy newspapers to online, right? So that there's also a kind of technological lag.
Yeah.
That as people are trying to figure out how to then basically do a lot more of their stuff online.
The more salacious the headline, the more clicks, and that's how the fake news sites get raise revenue. I guess my biggest thing is we have to make sure we're distinguishing between opinion and actual fake news, and that's my biggest fear, is that we really have a big crackdown on this, you know, this citizen journalism, if you will. And
but the problem is we're also... Now we're just disregarding it no matter where it's coming from. We see that, it's come from this source, period. I'm not going to like it. If I'm on the right and I see a Think Progress, I'm not going to like it. If I'm on the left and I see something else, I'm not going to like it. No matter how good the point actually is, because it's from this particular site is, no matter who wrote it, like because it comes from this site, I'm just going to disregard it immediately.
Well, so I'll end up sharing something from Huffington Post because if it's something that I want to, you know, generate a discussion about, I will never generate anything from something called like Red Flag News or even CNS or any of those sites because they're clearly hyper-partisan sites.
Or Craigslist Live.
That is an amazing fake news site. Right. You should go there now.
All right. But I mean, but I will say, though, that it appears people are interested in facts. That NPR, for example, did for the first time live fact checking during the debates, and it garnered almost 8 million views.
Absolutely. I will say I found a lot more people were watching C-SPAN, were listening to NPR, and without all of the other stuff going on, just the straight, this is what's happening. And people really liked it.
We are having coffee and conversation in the break room. I could do every single Friday. My guests this week, Robbie Medwed, Atlanta-based LGBT activist, Greg Williams of the conservative radio show Greg's List, Hector Fernandez of Georgia State, and with her debut in the break room today, Falguni Sheth, professor of philosophy at Emory's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. And we want to say a big thank you. Since I mentioned coffee, we have to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters, as we do every week. They donate the coffee that we drink. It is delicious. And you can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. Okay. Hillary Clinton supporters, very disappointed by her not becoming the first female president. I don't think anybody, you have to be a supporter to be disappointed. I mean, I think most Americans might want a first female president. Is that fair? To finally break the glass ceiling?
Condoleezza Rice, she'd be an outstanding one.
I think any time we get a first would be good. Okay. During her campaign, though, Clinton made that promise to shatter the ceiling.
I know we have still not shattered that highest and hardest glass ceiling, but someday someone will, and hopefully sooner than we might think right now.
So that mantra became a symbol of inspiration for a lot of women. Clinton lost, though. Ceiling still intact. And we wonder, is her loss a setback now for women in politics? Does this make it harder for the next presidential candidate?
Not at all.
Why not?
Because it seems to me that it's a noisy signal. It's not clear to me that she got defeated because she was a woman. It's not clear that she got a popular vote purely because she was a woman. I mean, she had all kinds of different politics. And it seems to me that, you know, we have to get used to seeing women on the national stage running. We already have all kinds of local women, you know, polls in state legislatures, in Congress, in the Senate. So no, actually, I'm not at all convinced that this is a setback for women. And in fact, if anything, what it shows is that, you know, you can actually have a whole range of women out there who don't necessarily speak to, you know, to all feminists or all women voters. So I'm actually pretty optimistic. I think that, you know, this is a kind of moment for kind of getting used to seeing women on the national stage.
All right, there's our one female speaker. You guys,
I would agree. I think any woman, any person, any politician that takes a step back because somebody else they liked got knocked down was never really in it to begin with, wholeheartedly. I think politicians are a special breed of people who stand on the shoulders of others who don't let that kind of thing stop them, and those who really want it will do it. But there are plenty of other glass ceilings to break. We need. You know, there are no women in Congress from Georgia right now. There's no women statewide really doing anything at that level. We've got people in the state legislature, but we need far, far more. So I think there are plenty of places to break glass ceilings.
Greg's point notwithstanding, I mean, you know, the fact is that it was a white woman who ran. Why not have black women? Why not have other women of color? You know, Condi Rice's would not be my favorite. Hillary was also not my favorite. I'll be quite honest with you, but I don't think that necessarily says to us that we're setting back women's agendas or women's politics.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Hillary Clinton was a recycled politician that was unable to inspire a lot of folks. A swath of the left
at
didn't
this
come
point,
out.
She's winning the popular vote by 2.3 million.
Yeah, but I mean, she lost three stronghold states in the Midwest, running up the score in California and New York.
That just shows electoral college doesn't work. That's different.
It always works for the winning side, and the side that loses always claims defeat.
Well, it hasn't worked for a while.
Let's not get too sidetracked on the electoral college.
I think it actually clears the path for a new, I guess, class of female politicians to be able to step outside of that shadow where we have like one family rule for, you know, a generation, where we had the Bushes, we had the Clintons.
It felt like a bit of a dynastic entitlement, right? And so why not actually have a whole
it was her
range?
Turn.
Yeah, and why not have a whole range of women who have different
politics and platforms? That's un-American for one. And second, it might be to the benefit of new generations because now they realize they're going to have a squeaky clean record so that they're not demonized to the extent that Hillary was.
And I think she took a lot of the heat that other people might have taken. Like, she was a tough person. She could take a lot of that heat, get through it the first time.
She took
it a long time. She broke down a lot of those walls, and people will see through that on the next time around.
So, okay. The question is, do women actually have to be more demanding and, I guess, dare we say nasty, in order to get what they want?
Now, could you please go home and get some sleep and let this matter be resolved?
Thank you, officer. Let's just go home, Leslie.
Yeah, let's go home.
Let's just go home.
No!
Let's just go home.
No! No!
Easy.
No! No, 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 no!
Okay, come with me, please.
Fine, I'd love to come with you.
Okay, a new study published in European Work and Organizational Management suggests demanding women get paid more. It says women who, quote, express their expectations and do not back down from demands earn more than women who tend to acquiesce to others. Men still make more than women, regardless of what their personality is. So does it mean that you really have to be a demanding woman if you're going to get paid the same or better wage?
Yes, women have to be vocal. It pays to be vocal, and it's not only for women. It's for other ethnicities, too.
But
anything you get, you have to claim it. Nobody's going to give anything to you for free.
But women have to walk a really fine line. Yeah. I mean, the fact is that you can be demanding, but if you're too demanding, it works against you. Remember, there was a case about 15, 20 years ago about, you know, somebody who was up to be the CEO of a corporation who basically got turned down because she was thought to be way too aggressive and, dare I say it, the B word, right?
So,
not just women, but white women may have that kind of space. I don't think black women, women of color, have that kind of space. And let's face it, I mean, as you pointed out, Celeste, I mean, this is also about a bit of patriarchy, the P word, right?
Hector just espoused personal responsibility. I'm going to buy you a drink after this. That's amazing.
So I'm going to jump in and say, you know, I'm not going to at all tell women how to behave and how to be better by any means.
Thank you, Robbie.
I am going to say that I think a lot of this falls onto men. If we really care about ensuring that people are equal to us, then it's time for us to speak up also. And it's hard for us to say, look, I'm getting however many $1,000s more than this person, but they are equally as good as I am. Why are you not paying us both equally? If we want to call ourselves feminist allies, then it's time for us to do the job, even if that means that we're going to get set back a little bit to bring someone else up.
But it's also about law, right? You have to be a better self-promoter, too.
The fact is we had the Lilly Ledbetter 2014 Act for, you know, equal wages, but the fact is that there's also Hispanic women are earning 63 cents to white women. To white men,
And black women.
Black women are earning, $7.70 or $7.69
Yeah. And white women make more money than Latinos
and Asian women,
African Americans, and so on.
And
so,
by the way, Asian women earn more than white women. They're 85 cents on the dollar. Is that because all Asian women are just incredibly demanding like me?
They're hard negotiators.
So who's at the top?
white guys.
White heterosexual males.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, so you're hearing the voices of our break room gang, Falguni Sheth of Emory University, Hector Fernandez of Georgia State, Robbie Medwed, Atlanta-based LGBT activist, and Greg Williams of the radio show Greg's List. All right, let's talk about something a little bit lighter. Time Magazine has posted its list of the worst songs of 2016. Let's take a listen to one of them. If there's something weird and it don't look good, who can you call? That is Fall Out Boy's version of the Ghostbusters theme, which is universally reviled, I believe. Some others on the list include Can't Stop the Feeling by Justin Timberlake, which was supposedly the song of the summer, and Private Show by Britney Spears. So, okay, as far as you guys are concerned, what do you think is the worst song of the year?
Well, that Ghostbusters was terrible.
Right?
Yeah,
that's awful.
I mean, that is the first time I've heard it. I looked at the list. It really was. I will say, I don't disagree with the list because I don't know most of the songs, but I will say that I think Can't Stop the Feeling, it was not it's not a technically good song. There's nothing artistically redeeming about it, but it's fun. I enjoyed it when it came on. I was not so upset with that one.
Yeah, it shouldn't be on that list compared to that first, the Fall Out Boy song. The movie was awful and the song matched the movie.
Oh my God, no, I'm sorry. The movie was great. It was great.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God. So,
a party of one over here.
No, I'm sorry. So. I'm sorry.
All right. I'm going to throw down on that one.
And the female Ghostbusters actually made more money than the male Ghostbusters in that
because
one.
It's 2016, doofus.
I'm going to nominate a song. I'm going to nominate Closer by the Chainsmokers, which is horrible. I mean,
I actually love that song.
Oh, God. I'm sorry.
Did you
That's
see
horrible.
The Trump Mac mix-up where they dubbed Trump singing that? It's awesome. Y'all, even the most vehemently anti-Trump people would like it.
I hear they're playing at the inauguration. Chainsmokers. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Which makes sense.
All right. Well, let me put this out to the listeners because I know you guys listen to music, and I bet you have ideas on what is the worst song of the year. We want to get your recommendations. You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can tweet us. You know how to reach us at OST Talker Post on Facebook. All right, let's continue with the discussion of bad music, shall we? A woman in Oregon called the police because a man was whistling the song Closing Time by the band Semisonic.
Closing time, you don't have to go home, but you can.
Okay, that's a bad song.
That's so lame.
I like that song.
Her complaint to the police was the man was whistling the tune obnoxiously and would not stop.
Auditory assault, right?
Right. Yeah. So I know there is at least one song that all of us would call the cops on if they were singing it near us all the time. For my son, my son sings that song Friday by Rebecca Black.
Friday.
Yeah.
Gotta get down on Friday.
That was an invitation.
Oh, come on. Party.
Because I was mentioning it as something that was obnoxious.
Yes.
So he does that to torture me. What are you guys? What's the song that's horrible?
Hanson's Mbop.
Oh, that's a good one.
Oh, you just broke our producer Sean Powers' heart.
Kill me. If you want to find a way to kill me, just play that.
I will say, as a guy who's been a camp counselor for about 15 years, Wonderwall.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, Beyonce Single Ladies. That one, when I hear...
Single Ladies.
Yeah. Actually, your version is better. Can we do karaoke one Friday here?
I think it'd be great.
Robbie's clearly got his song picked
Absolutely.
up.
Absolutely.
Hector, you got a song that would drive you crazy?
Only Pleasant Melodies in my mind.
elevator music is
No elevator music. You don't even want to imagine.
Well, here's the other question about this then. Is it fair to call the police? I mean, would you want the police to come out and get... He was standing right next to her driveway while she was working and just singing it straight into her face.
Who does this?
Who calls the cops for this?
Also, who stands on somebody's driveway and just sings at them?
That's what I'm worried about.
That's creepy.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't call the police for the fact that they're singing, but that's definitely stalking.
That's more of like harassment and stalking, I would say.
Did this guy know that it was really irritating her?
Yeah. She kept asking
him,
please stop.
Well, guys can be
kind of
clueless, just saying. But they
can't. Like, really?
So no means yes, right?
No.
Okay, so Sam Burnham tweets, call me maybe and you're going to prison.
Perhaps she was calling the rock band now that Sting is coming back.
All right. Okay. Let's move on. A bipartisan bill to include women in the draft failed this week because of conservative opposition. President Obama, if you remember, lifted the ban on women in combat in 2015.
Do Code Red still happen on this base, Colonel?
Joe, the Colonel doesn't need to answer that.
Yes, he does.
No, he really doesn't.
Yeah, he really does. Colonel.
You know, it just hit me. She outranks you, Danny.
Okay, so what do we think here? Should women register for the draft, and why would... Let me go to you first, Greg, because why are conservatives...
He's the foil.
I get to set the bar really low. All right.
If we're talking about, you know, having everybody take personal responsibility, why would conservatives not want women to be registered?
I think there's still that halcyon view of we have to protect women. And there's actually studies in the Army that there's chivalry and men acting like gentlemen. Those haven't disappeared as much as the feminist movement would like it to. So we still have that. And actually some studies in the Army show that women and men fighting in similar combat units, that men would act illogically to protect a woman. Now, these are studies done by the Army. This is not me. These are facts, statistics. You can look them up. You can read about it.
Keep on going, Greg.
We got more shovels for you.
I'm done.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in here?
I mean, it seems right. I mean, they should be required to register for the draft if we're really kind of espousing some notion of equality. On the other hand, you know, I'm not sure that this is a particularly feminist position, right? It's like basically requiring women to register for a draft in order to, you know.
Do we need the draft, though?
It's been 40-something years. Well, that's what Sam Burnham tweets that also. Why does anyone in a free society have to sign up for
constriction? I mean, we've had it. It's been over 40 years. I've signed up for the draft. I'm sure we all have. But we've never really needed it.
Falcony and
well,
I have
you guys
actually,
haven't.
I had to because they thought, well, I actually got a selective service.
They thought Falcony was a boy's name?
Exactly. Well, it is, actually.
Oh.
But I would say, if we're going to do it, let's do it equally. But I would say, let's just get rid of it. We haven't had a time to need it. We thought we were going to have it. I remember in college, there was a big fear when we started the Iraq War that we were going to get drafted. There were a lot of us who had those conversations. But if we're going to do it, let's do it equally. Yeah, maybe there are certain attitudes that have carried over, but that's been true any time that the Army has changed. We integrated, Don't Ask, Don't Tell got fallen. All of those things happened, and people have to retrain, and they have to learn, and that's just how it is. They follow orders. That's just how it is. Why not now with the same thing?
Well, that's
and even the White
question,
House came
though.
Out. The White House came out in support of it also last night, and they might just be trolling people. Which is very possible. You know, they've got a few months left. Maybe they're saying, hey, let's just see what happens.
49 days left.
Yeah, I'm sure they're like, let's just throw this up in the air, see what
happens.
Well,
I mean, I think that we need to focus on keeping a volunteer army. That should be the real focus and not
saying. Yeah, but
saying,
if draft happens, we have Trump as president. If we have a war, everybody should be allowed to, you know, register for the draft. Women are not weak, period. They should be allowed to draft, to go for the draft.
Oh, I know plenty of men whose butts I could kick.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So.
At least two of them are in the room.
She has a man's name, so. Hey.
And that's the first clue.
I'm just saying, look, you have to pass a test to get into whatever selective service anyway, so if a woman passes it, who cares?
Right, they're not going
to
throw everybody on the front lines. Yeah. My father was drafted in Vietnam. He worked with computers in Germany. You know, he was not on the front lines, but he was drafted and he did his job, and that was it.
All right, it's fair enough. We are out of time in the break room today. I want to say thank you to all my guests. Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University. I thought you were going to shorten that title. Robbie Medwed, Atlanta-based LGBT activist, and Greg Williams is host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. And I want to say thank you to our rookie, not shy, Falgani Sheth, professor of philosophy at Emory's Department of Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies. Thanks, guys.
Have
a great weekend.
Thanks, Les.
That's our show for today, but we always want to hear from you. You know that. Do you think women should have to register for the draft? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. We're also on Facebook, or you can reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk, and I am at Celeste Headley. For today and the week, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great weekend.